This is The Gaggle with David Helfenbein.
This week on The Gaggle, we are very lucky to have on Thomas Mann. Tom is a senior fellow for governance studies at the Brookings Institution and resident scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at University of California, Berkeley. Tom, it is a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for coming on.
David, I'm really happy to be with you.
Tom, I'd like to start out by asking you how much government has changed, in your opinion, since you first moved to Washington. And now I know you live in California, but since today, when you have written The Broken Branch, and it's even worse than it looks, which has now come out in a new and expanded edition. What is your opinion on how government has changed, and has it gotten better or worse in many ways?
David, I have to say that although I've long been an optimist and have enormous respect and regard for American political institutions and American political culture, and as you know, long defended Congress as the first branch of government, I think our politics has deteriorated seriously in the last couple of decades. When I first came to Washington in 1969, I recall the heated debates on the floor of the Senate between, say, George McGovern and Bob Dole over the war in Vietnam. And then I would see them walk off the floor, arm in arm, talking about how to pass a farm bill with food stamp coverage. Those were the times when there were vehement disagreements, but in the end, there was a certain acceptance of and respect for the other side, in this case, the other party and the individuals within them. We've really lost that now. I think our politics in Washington is best described as open warfare. And it turns out that in the last couple of decades, much of the problem has come from the radicalization of the Republican Party. As you know, I am sort of professionally nonpartisan. I do my best to describe the political world as it exists. I'm not carrying anyone's water politically, but Norm and I both, my co-author Norm Ornstein, and I both came to see the changes that had occurred within the Republican Party. Our most recent book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, we said in a sentence that's been the most quoted, the Republican Party has become an insurgent outlier, ideologically extreme, contemptuous of the inherited social and economic policy regime, skeptical of facts, evidence, and science, scornful of compromise, and completely unwilling to accept the legitimacy of its political opposition. That pretty much sets it up for you, and it's that war that's been proceeding that over the last couple of decades that took on a new intensity with Barack Obama's election to the White House that really reflects how much Washington has changed.
Were you surprised by Donald Trump's candidacy going so far or not?
I have to tell you, the answer to that is no, although my co-author and dear colleague, Norm Ornstein, was the one who went in print last year in the fall saying we were politically right for this kind of a candidacy, and it's a candidacy that could only occur on the Republican side of the aisle because of the extent to which the party had become so vehemently oppositional and so disdainful of President Obama And they really encouraged the election of the sort of Tea Partiers and engaged in a degree of hostage taking and ugliness, really, that made promises to their supporters that they would change everything if they came into the majority party. And of course, those are promises they couldn't have kept, shouldn't have made, given the fact that Obama was in the White House and could veto anything that they did. But I think that created along with our other economic and social changes that have really been harmful to a substantial segment of Americans, it created a sort of an anger at elites more generally, including Republican Party elites, and set the climate in which a Donald Trump could arise.
There's a lot of research that I know you and the Brookings Institution have done on polarization, and the Broken Branch focused on that as well. How has D.C. become more polarized over the years, and can you provide some examples of that?
Well, it's evident most dramatically in the Congress as you look at voting patterns and you see the division between the parties in both the House and the Senate is larger now than any time since the Civil War. Part of it is sort of ideological differentiation. The Republicans have become more consistently conservative and the Democrats more consistently liberal, especially with the demise of the old Dixiecrats, the Southern Democrats, after the Voting Rights Act changed things. So you see it there, and now it's not about individual members of Congress anymore. It's really about teams, you know, shirts and skins. In this case, it's the Democrats and the Republicans, and everything is partisan. It's really hyper-partisan to the extent of being tribal. And in this case, Obama would be criticized for not going up to Capitol Hill and really campaigning personally for his proposals. But the people who made the criticisms didn't understand that for Obama to go public is to ensure absolute Republican opposition. The only way you could get anything done was A, having the votes as he did in his first 2 years in office, but other than that, doing it quietly and subtly and hoping on some matters that aren't caught up in the most extreme ideological battles, you could get something done. But if he's for it, we're against it, even if we were for it a year ago. So that's reflected there. It poisons the relationship between the executive and legislative branches when you have a period of divided party government, which is now the norm. It's clearly affected the Supreme Court, where, unlike the normal pattern in history, every member of the court's nominating a president determines whether he's in the liberal or the conservative bloc. And it's a warfare that involves partisan media and the internet and vast party networks and intense feelings that carries all the way down to state and local government. It's really been quite an extraordinary period of time. Now, if we had a parliamentary system of government, you'd have a majority running the government and then being held accountable after putting their program in place. But we have a separated system of government, separate institutions sharing power. It requires collaboration across branches, across the houses of Congress. It really requires a willingness to engage in good faith bargaining and compromise, and that's something that is mostly impossible these days. And it's so awful to observe it, to see it, to realize how much it holds us back from doing things that would be very constructive in our politics. And saddest of all, the public doesn't really know what's wrong. They just know it's awful. So they have this generalized, amorphous hatred, distrust of Congress, of Washington, of government, not really fully realizing how much this is a problem of partisan disagreement, and some of it is rooted in their own strong feelings, either left or right politically, but certainly it's more intensive at the level of political elites.
What can we do to fix the problem, Tom?
There's no good ways. We have devoted years suggesting things that we might do. The second half of It's Even Worse Than It Looks really discusses the kind of changes that might make a difference. I mean, the most important thing to do is for us to get back to a point where we have two major parties that differ, but are center-left and center-right, both of whom aspire to govern in a constructive way. Real differences, but an acceptance of the legitimacy of the other. Right now, it's the radicalization of the Republican Party. And now, with Donald Trump violating sort of every norm expected for a president, he's the most unqualified, unsuited, and unpopular person to garner a major party nomination for the presidency in American history. And I see him as really a dangerous force. This is a test of Americans and their understanding, willingness to take steps to save our democratic system, our constitutional system, our freedoms and our respect for others, our open borders, and our insistence that everyone really have a chance to make it in this country. It's a serious time, and there's no little fix in the rules or changes in the electoral system that's going to bring that about. It's going to have to come from the electorate. If Trump ends up as discredited in November as he is now, and there's a landslide election, that might get the Republicans thinking again about how that happened. It might also put the Democrats in a position of governing for a while. But the key thing is we're not going to do well with a permanent one-party dominant system. We need two healthy parties, and right now one is sick, and they've just experienced a hostile takeover by Mr. Trump.
You are both a scholar and a professor now. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today?
David, so much of it is serendipity. I went to high school and college in Florida. I was originally planning on going to law school, but a political science professor got a hold of me and said, you don't want to do that. It's so much more interesting studying politics, and encouraged me to apply for graduate school, which I did. I accepted a fellowship at the University of Michigan. I loved it. I learned a lot. After 3 years, finishing my exams, but before doing a dissertation, I I won a congressional fellowship, which gave me a year to work inside the Congress. I stayed what I thought would be temporarily working for the American Political Science Association. Eventually took a leave, wrote my dissertation, got my PhD, and built a career that kept me in Washington, but a foot in both camps. That is to say, I was close to the policy process and the political process, mainly as an observer, but I was also had a foot in the academic world at APSA, and then I went on to Brookings, where I directed the governmental studies program for a dozen years. So, but there were various points at which I could have easily had a lifelong career as a professor. There was a time after doing polling for candidates for Congress on the side, I could have gone off into commercial polling and did become a pollster, but I kept doing what I was doing, which is research and staying close to the political and policy process. I saw that was unusual, but it was an interesting way to build a career, and I never regretted a day of it. Brookings was a fabulous place to work. I was able to build a program and do my own work and come to know many people in politics and come to write about it in a way I hope that showed I had some value to add on the basis of my experience. Now I'm getting older, but I was going full speed ahead. But when both my children settled out in San Francisco, and one of them, my son, has two very young children. My grandsons, Leo and Luca. I thought it was time not to be a continent away from them. So we moved out here. I'm settled in at the University of California, Berkeley. I taught a course this last term for upper division undergraduates on America's dysfunctional politics, but I still do work for Brookings, and so I have a very interesting life, and it's actually good to get a somewhat different perspective. Now, I grant you, Berkeley is not your average community. People kiddingly call it the People's Republic of Berkeley, but it turns out there's a lot of young people, and it's been fascinating to teach during this very interesting nomination season. And all in all, I realize that one does have opportunities. Everything isn't set in cement. Eventually, opportunities present themselves, and the direction you take really has opens doors. Obviously, tends to close others. But I think it was the openness to doing things differently than was expected of a PhD student that really brought a very interesting and rewarding career to me.
And so for my final question, if a student came to you today and asked you career advice, whether they wanted to be a professor or something else that they really enjoyed and had a passion for, what advice would you give them?
Well, the key is figuring out who you are, what you care about, and what interests you, and what you want to do, where you can contribute, make, you know, some genuine value added. I had a student this last time who's going to be working at the Democratic Convention who's probably my best student, but he wants to go into politics. He wants to run for office. And I said, God knows we need you. We need bright, able people who are willing to do that job. But there are others who want to study it and understand it. The key point is to look around, to try different things out, to find some some really good professors who will help you understand what careers and possible life commitments are with regard to one's profession. There are opportunities, and to be to be skeptical, to be open-minded, to not assume you know everything, to not be swept up by some ideological fervor without testing it in the real world of politics and policy. We need people who care about the system, that are not negative but positive, that understand we've done some remarkable things in 230 years in spite of the shortcomings, and part of the reason is because we managed to attract enough people into public life, elective or career service, and that's what's kept the whole system afloat.
Tom, man, thank you so much for coming on.
Happy to catch up with you again, David.